Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
Succeed at last. Persecution you must fear. Win and lose, you've got to get your share. Got your mind set on a dream. You can get it, no harder than they seem now. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. Succeed at last. I know it.
Listen.
Rome was not built in a day. Opposition will come your way. But the hotter the battle you see, it's the sweeter the victory. Now you can get it if you really want.
Hello and welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is where we meet some of the most influential figures in music and take a look at the pivotal first moments that made them who they are today. Today's guest helped change the face of popular music, taking the music of his native Jamaica around the world, penning classic songs, influencing generations of Western musicians and becoming arguably the first reggae superstar. I'm proud to have as my guest this week, Mr. Jimmy Cliff. In this week's show, Jimmy looks back over a remarkable career. His precociously talented youth, he had his first hit single, Hurricane Hattie, when he was just 14. He shares his memories of the burgeoning ska scene emerging out of Kingston and signing to the pioneering record label Island. He also talks about the prejudices he had to face moving to the UK in the mid-60s and his rise to fame with mainstream hits like Wonderful World, Beautiful People and the song you just heard, You Can Get It If You Really Want. He also talks about his artistic links with Western stars like Bob Dylan, Paul Simon and Bruce Springsteen and his role as the iconic reggae gangster in the film The Harder They Come. And I started by asking Jimmy, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
I guess it must have been the time of going to church with my family.
Well,
this may be the last time.
Be my last
this may
time.
Be the last time.
Be the last time.
The last
I don't know.
I don't know.
Be my last time. Sing together.
They were all churchgoers, and so I like that part of the church, just the music part of it. So yeah, that's when I became really aware of the musical likeness that I have for it.
And you felt like a connection with it straight away?
Oh yeah, because it moved me. It moved me as a child, and I saw the people moving. You know, I went to one of those churches where people, there's a lot of music, you know. And I saw the people moving, and it moved me as well.
This was in St. James, yeah?
In St. James, right.
Was it quite a musical family that you grew up in?
Everyone sang. We didn't have instruments in those times, but everyone sang. We would sit around and make music together. Quite a big family. And so everyone was quite musical.
When did you make that jump from thinking, I just like music, to thinking, I am going to be a musician?
It was also in school at, maybe 8, 9 or something like that.
So young?
Yeah. It was break time in the school and I was in a classroom singing. And some girls walked out and said, where's the radio? So, oh, wow, I have something here. I thought to myself.
Girls like this as
yeah,
well.
Yeah. And so those were some girls who really wouldn't normally look at me. So.
Who were your kind of musical heroes then, when you were young?
Well, there were lots of music, indigenous music in Jamaica, you know. There were music for almost everything, working, weddings, digging, all those kind of things. So those were indigenous music. But besides that, there was people from New Orleans, jazz people from New Orleans and R&B people from New Orleans, like Professor Longhair. Domino and, you know, people like that. Because those were the ones we could pick up on the radio.
What were some of those key tracks that you remember loving at that age?
Fats Domino, Be My Guest. He was one of my great people who inspired me a lot.
Come on, baby, and be my guest. Come join the party and meet the rest. Everything's gonna be all right. So be my guest tonight. We're gonna dance. I'm gonna make you queen for days. Everything's gonna be alright. So be my guest tonight.
What was it about him that you loved so much?
Beat and, you know, his unique sound of a voice and the piano playing, you know. So yeah, Fats Domino, great.
And then you moved to Kingston, didn't you?
I moved to Kingston.
That was kind of, I'm going to be a musician time.
Yeah, I moved to Kingston. Then after listening to all those music on the radio, I heard one local artist, Derek Morgan. And one of my teachers said, that's a local artist. He said he writes his own songs. So I said, oh, how does he write his own songs? He said, you just write it. So so I did that. I did just that. And I wrote about 4 songs. And I had them. I sang them to a few people. And they said, wow, you did write that? I said, yeah. And so it was time for me to go to Kingston to go to school, to change school. So I had like 4 songs in my pocket ready to say, when I go to Kingston, I must get them recorded like this singer that I heard on the radio.
You make it sound really easy and really casual.
But no, I was very excited about it because having sang in that classroom and then those girls gravitated towards me, I said, wow, you know, there could be a lot more things to happen. So, you know, I went to Kingston and I started looking around to get my songs recorded.
And what happened then? I mean, this is your first experience in a recording studio, I guess.
Yeah, I entered a talent parade. And I lost one and I won a few.
Okay.
And then after that, after testing many different producers, I finally found one who would record me.
Who was?
And his name was Sir Cavaliers. And then after Sir Cavaliers, I found Leslie Kong, who was Beverly's. And we really had a great relationship. I stuck with him for a number of years.
Tell me a bit about Hurricane Hattie. That was one of the first breakthrough tracks, wasn't it?
That was my, my first hit. And Hurricane Hattie was a hurricane that had blown in Belize in South America. And so I decided to make a song about it. It was an eventful thing, so I made a song about it, and it became a hit. My first number one hit in Jamaica.
It still sounds like a really vital, really fresh-sounding record when you hear it. Do you remember the sessions themselves?
Oh, yeah. You know, the session was, in those days, it was like just everybody recorded in two tracks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you record with the musicians, start playing, and you sang, and everybody was in the same room together, and you sang. And for me, it was so exciting, you know. And I still get that kind of excitement today when I hear the band strike up. Because the great thing for me was when the band strike up, I hear all those chords and everything together. Wow, I feel goosebumps all over my body, and I just belt the song out.
But we're over there, my lovely, I'm coming over.
Was the start, as you say, of like a run of tracks and singles that you did with Leslie Kung, and you started to grow and grow and grow. Could you feel like part of a movement that was getting more kind of popular, or just
I realize that it was a movement happening because the music now had a name. They called it ska, and when I first went to Kingston, didn't really have a name. So, yeah, I realized a movement was about happening, and I kind of realized too that I'm a part of this movement.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was an exciting thing.
How did you start working with Chris Blackwell at Ireland? So 1964?
Chris Blackwell used to come into Leslie Kung's record shop, and he'd just look at titles of songs. And somebody said, you know, who's Chris Blackwell? I said, well, who is Chris Blackwell? I said, oh, he has Island Records, and he's, you know, he's a producer, and he told me some of the artists that he produced. I said, oh, okay. And then in 1965, I went to the New York World's Fair. And
yes, you were representing Jamaica.
Yes, Jamaica. Yes,
that's amazing.
yes. Good. Then I had a few hits under my belt, and so yeah, they and I was I've always been a good performer, so they asked me to fill that slot. However, that's when I met Chris Blackwell, and he invited me to come to England. And I said, well, America here is pretty good for me. I don't think...
the weather's good. I like it here.
Yeah. Yes, but he said, look, I mean, you know, Millie Small, look how well I've done with Millie Small. And, you know, you have a really good voice and you're a good performer. You could achieve just the same or more. And I thought about it for a few months and then I came to England, yeah.
London is the place for me. London, this lovely city. You can go to France or America, India, Asia or Australia, but you must come back to London City.
Well, what was London like in the mid-60s?
Well, London was exciting to me because there were lots of clubs. Lots of clubs around. There were in Jamaica. There were clubs, but here it was different. And there were various kinds of music from, you know, Africa, Caribbean, other Caribbean islands. And I was open to more rock music and all various forms of music that I was not so exposed to in Jamaica. So it was a very exciting time for me when I came to London.
Which other artists did you kind of fall in love with? Which kind of British artists?
Well, it was the time of the British uprising, I would call it, of music from like Beatles to the Stones to, you know, everybody at that time. And I went to a few concerts and Chris Blackwell introduced me to some of them. And so, yeah, you know, it was a great time.
I was born.
Face much discrimination? Because I think it's kind of, it's maybe different if you're an artist, if you're a musician, because you're mixing with other musicians, but still, was it, I mean, what was it like in...
Oh, yeah, London? I faced some kind of discrimination. I remember one incident at the first flat I was staying in, somebody has got the flat for me. And so I checked in into this flat, and when I was there for about maybe 2-3 weeks, the caretaker came in one morning and said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I live here." I said, "Well, Wash, don't you know that we don't have black people here?" I said, "Wow. Well, if you want me out, you'll have to get me out on my head." So I slammed the door. And however, like the following day, I was on a big, I was on Top of the Pops, not performing, but I was a part of the audience, and I was there. And then the next day I went back and she said, "Oh, I saw you on the telly last night." So now everything was all right for me to stay. So yeah, you know, when you become a celebrity and all of that, you prior to that, of course, the discrimination thing and all of that. But then when you could become a celebrity, it's okay.
In 69, you released the Jimmy Cliff album, which included Wonderful World, Beautiful People, big international hit. I mean, you talked about a movement earlier. This is where it starts to spread around the world. That must have felt, that's been very proud, I guess.
Absolutely. This was like my dream coming true. That's what I came to England for. And the dream was happening now. So it was now, you know, so different, completely different level of the game I was playing now, you know.
Your songwriting was really developing as well.
Yes. I wrote those songs, all of the songs like Wonderful World, Many Rivers to Cross, and those songs on that album, while on a trip to South America, Brazil. And then I went back to Jamaica and recorded them. So yeah, my songwriting skills were coming to fruition now.
Did you enjoy the fame side of things?
I enjoyed it. At the same time, it had its kind of an odd side too, where I started have to be careful of what I say, because I noticed that, you know, you're saying that. And so I noticed the two sides. But yeah, I enjoy the fame.
Like what? What? Just people?
Well, I mean, if I walk into a store or something and they recognize me, service would be nice. Things like that. So Yeah, yeah, I enjoy those kind of things. Oh, doors open a little easier.
We've got to talk about Vietnam, which is one of your many famous tracks. And, I mean, we can't mention it without the Bob Dylan quote, can we? Bob Dylan called it the best protest song he'd ever heard, which is pretty impressive.
pretty impressive.
But a brave thing for you to do as well.
I found it something natural that I did. And it's something that I still do naturally. I mean, I am touched and become sensitive to things like that on the planet, you know, what I consider to be unjust or not right and all those kind of things. So it's something I just do naturally.
Did you get a lot of criticism from people at the time?
Yes. I mean, after Wonderful World came out, and then Vietnam was supposed to, well, came out as the next single, it was criticized a lot. So, you know, but it didn't really bother me.
That was Jimmy Cliff's famous anti-war song, Vietnam, a huge success across the world and a track that Bob Dylan supposedly called the best protest song I've ever heard. And you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Jimmy Cliff.
Six Music.
Six. Welcome back to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, here on 6 Music, and my guest this week, one of the most successful reggae stars of all time and a songwriting hero, Mr. Jimmy Cliff. And that was Paul Simon, a close friend of Jimmy Cliff, with Mother and Child Reunion, recorded in 1972 in Jamaica with Jimmy Cliff's backing group.
At the start of the 70s, you were doing amazingly well. Lots of your songs were being covered by other people. And then Leslie Kong, who you said you'd had a very long relationship, passed away. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with him. It must have been very difficult when he died.
Yeah, it was very difficult because he was really a creative person. You know, he was full of ideas. You know, why don't you write a song about that? Mm. You know, so it's good to be around people who can, like, you know, feed you with ideas and, you know, suggestions. However, having been here in England, I was also making other kind of connections mm-hmm. with other people. So the loss of Leslie Kong was kind of deep for me, but maybe not as deep as some of the other artists like Desmond Dekker. For myself, my connections, why I said that is because my connections here, I had made hits with collaboration with Cat Stevens as producer and writer and a few other people. So I saw that, look, I can still get along with my production and things, even with the loss of Leslie Kong. But it was a deep loss, yeah.
Now that I've lost everything to you, you said you wanna start something new, and it's breaking my heart to leave.
And one of the kind of last things that he started work on that then grew was The Harder They Come. How did you first get involved in the soundtrack and that film? Because it's quite a piece of
day,
work.
One day I was at Dynamic Sounds, the very famous studio that a lot of the hits were made at that time. And I was recording one of the hit songs, You Can Get It If You Really Want.
Big song?
Yes. I came out and I met this gentleman who said to me, you know, I'm making a movie. Do you think you could write some songs for it? I said, what do you mean if I think I could write? I can write. I can do anything. And he was kind of taken aback with my response. So the next thing I knew, he sent a script to me.
As quick as that?
Sent a script, like 3 months after. He sent a script to me via Island Records. And I read the script and I could identify with the character. I knew of the character as a child growing up. You know, Ivan Martin. He struck terror in the minds of people, when in the hearts of people, when that name was called. And so I knew the character. So, and I've always wanted to act. Actually, matter of fact, that was the first thing I wanted to do, even before I wanted to sing. So he came over and he ran a scene with me. I was still living in London. And he ran a scene with me, the scene with the mother and that scene. And he was satisfied. Well, you know, this is the guy I've been looking for all these years to do my movie. So the next thing, I went back to Jamaica and we started filming.
Because it's become such a seminal film. It's kind of responsible in many ways for helping introduce reggae music and reggae culture to Absolutely. America and the rest of the world. Did you kind of feel, once again, like the world might understand this?
Well, during the filming, we all kind of went into the film with vigor and hope and energy. And for me, when I lived here in London, I used to go to the West End a lot. I watched like 4 movies a day. And I always thought, wow, my movie could be shown here one day. So we went into it with big expectations, but never knowing if it would do anything or not. So I was very surprised, but pleasantly so. Even though I had my big expectation, I was still surprised that it had that big impact on the world.
Is obviously still regarded as a classic, and the album is one of the biggest selling, one of the biggest selling reggae albums of all time. What is it? What is it about the album and the film that make them so timeless, do you think?
I think we captured a time and the energy of a time. We really captured that energy. It was not just Jamaica, that kind of energy, but it was an energy that was going all over the planet at that time. And we captured it in that film. The character that I played, it could have been any character in England or the US or wherever, whatever part of the world. So we captured that. And that's what gives it its timelessness.
So many people have covered your songs. You mentioned Desmond Dekker, New Order, Willie Nelson, Keith Richards, an incredible list of people.
Yeah.
Who have done your favourite versions? Who are the ones that you especially like? You're like, oh yeah, you've done something interesting with that song.
Well, you know, I appreciated all of them because it was encouraging for me to see, you know, have my work covered. I have covered other people's work as well. So when I cover someone else's work, I try to make it my own.
Mm.
And that's the thing that catches me when I hear somebody covers my work and it's completely different from mine. So, for instance, when I heard Trapped by Bruce Springsteen,
yeah,
it's completely different from mine. And so I said, wow, wow, that's great. So that's one of them, you know, because it's so different, you know.
Well, it seems like I'm caught up in your trap again. And it seems like I'll be wearing the same old chain. Good will conquer evil, and the truth will set me free. And I know someday I'll find the key. And I know somewhere I'll find the key. Well, it seems like I've been playing the game way too long. And it seems the game I've played has made you strong. But when the game is over, I won't walk out a loser. Yeah, I know that I'll walk out of here again. Yeah, I know someday I'll walk out of here again. But now I'm trapped. Ooh, yeah. Trapped. Ooh, yeah. Trapped. Ooh, yeah. Trapped. Ooh, yeah.
Have you ever managed to meet Bruce and talk to him about it?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we performed together. I was doing an event in the US called South by Southwest, and he was performing there, and he asked me if I would participate to perform with him. So yeah, I went up and we did three songs. I did three songs with his band, and prior to that, we've done it before and we've talked, and so yeah, we have a good artistic relationship. Yeah.
You've always liked collaborating with people as well. Like certainly that
I love
goes through your life, yeah.
I love that because it brings out something else out of me. I think it's an artistic thing. When you see another artist do something, it's inspiring to see that. That's one of the things that I kind of miss in today's world with the technology that we have today. It has changed that a bit because, you know, somebody come in with one keyboard, at one keyboard can record everything. But back in the days when I recorded with, you know, 6-7 musicians sit in the room and you sat in the room and everybody starts playing, there's a vibe, there's an energy, you know, and I kind of miss that.
There's the Blackmagic album as well that's got lots of those collaborations on, isn't there?
Yes.
And there's the Joe Strummer one as well, who's someone
right,
who's a bit of a hero to me. What was he like to work with?
Joe Strummer was a fantastic guy. I mean, he was so bright. He came in with the lyrics and said, you know, I have these lyrics here and I hear Jimmy Cliff singing them. And Dave Stewart, who was producing the album, said, how does the melody go? He said, I don't have a melody. I just have these lyrics and I hear Jimmy Cliff singing them. So Dave started playing the guitar and I started humming a melody. And Joe came in with part of the melody. And the song just developed right there. And we had the song. And I think that was his... the last song he recorded in a studio. But Joe was you know, a brilliant guy.
They're shedding blood over the border. So who came first to these hills? Only the drums remember, cause the hand of the drummer was stilled. Oh, well, chaos and disorder always reign through. these hills. Peace will be slaughtered by anger, and the blood of the Lamb will be spilled.
When it comes to this new record, it says 50 years since you first stepped into a studio for the new album. Does it feel like 50 years?
It feels like yesterday.
Because the album's called Rebirth, isn't it?
Rebirth, indeed, yes.
So do you think about it in terms of this is just one more new thing to do?
It's a rebirth. I call the album Rebirth because it's a rebirth in many aspects. I am on a rebirth of my career at this time. And this album, I went back to point zero, which is the origin of the music. This album has like the original way, the original sound that we had. I recorded it live. I feel my career is on another rise again, taking another, you know, there were moments in my career where there was a rise. Wonderful World was one rise. Mm-hmm. Harder to Come was another rise. When I got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2010, that was another rise. And now I am on another rise because this album is really a great one. From my research that I've done, ancient Egyptian histories and all of that, I do think from their calendar point of view, the planet will be going to a new change, coming into a new energy and all of that. So,
rebirth.
Yeah.
Positive energy?
Yes.
Good.
Positive energy, absolutely. Yes, yes, yes.
1962, Orange Street, Kingston, Jamaica. I sang my song for Leslie Kahn. He said, let's go record it in the style of ska. So we did the track into the Beverly's All-Star back and forth. Reggae music gonna make me feel good. Reggae music gonna make me feel all right. Reggae music making me feel alright now.
Reggae music gonna make me feel good.
Reggae music gonna make me feel alright now. Reggae music making me feel good. Reggae music making me feel alright now. 1966, there was a new consciousness of civil rights, Vietnam War, and independence from British colonialists. Rockstar music was expressing all of this. From dynamic sounds with making me feel alright now.
Reggae music gonna make me feel good.
Reggae music gonna make me feel alright now. Reggae music making me feel good. Reggae music making me feel alright now. And grinning.
True.
Now reggae music is worldwide. There's nothing to hide.
Oh.
Reggae music gonna make me feel good. Reggae music gonna make me feel alright now. Reggae music gonna make me feel good. Reggae music making me feel alright now.
Reggae music gonna make me feel good.
Reggae music gonna make me feel alright now. Reggae music making me feel good. Reggae music making me feel alright now. Now 2012. Reggae music is still here.
True.
And the voice of the people everywhere.
True.
Whenever there is injustice and tyranny, reggae music is there.
True.
Standing up for the rights. That's a true life.
Reggae music gonna make me feel good. Reggae music gonna make me feel alright now. Reggae music gonna make me feel good.
Reggae music making me feel alright now.
Reggae music making me feel good.
Reggae music making me feel alright now.
Oh.
did you meet Tim Armstrong from Rancid? Because a great guy to work with, but I wouldn't necessarily put you two guys together.
Well, because the connection with reggae and punk, you know, is quite well known from the socio-political point of view. And Joe Strummer was really the one who introduced me to Tim's music. Mm. Well, my management suggested Tim Armstrong because I wanted to make a new album. And they said, well, how about Tim Armstrong? So we talked on the phone and the vibes felt really good. So we said, let's go to the studio. We went into the studio and the vibes felt really better. It just flowed. You know, he was exciting. He excited me. I was excited. And when I start hearing how he went back to the original sounds that we had, the dynamic sounds and all of that, wow, I said, wow, I've forgotten all about that. Oh, that's great. And the vibe just flowed.
You've been the only living musician to be ordered the Order of Merit, the highest honour that can be granted by the Jamaican government.
Yeah.
Well, to an artist. That's a pretty big...
It's a great honour, you know? I mean, to get honour outside of your country is really nice and wonderful. But when you get an honour in your own country and one like that, it's a good feeling.
It always seems to the outside world that the kind of history of Jamaican music is so closely linked to the kind of heart of Jamaica as a country. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes.
There's great pride in it. There's always
great pride in it, and the people and the politicians are very much aware of that situation, and sometimes they play with it, you know, from back in the 70s, because they see what the people are gravitating to, and they sometimes use it for good or for bad. But it's the thing with the Jamaican people. The music is like part of our oxygen.
You should have been a politician. You'd have been a great politician.
I was talking to somebody just last night, and she didn't know what kind of work I did. And she didn't know who I was. And then I said, you know, I'm into the music business and I sing and I play. She said, oh, I thought you were a politician. I said, wow, okay.
You're bringing people together with music. It's yeah. Similar, but you know, it's got more
heart.
Well,
I think the music is like beyond politics, really and truly, because like they say, it's the universal language. I think an artist, you know, music can be used positively or negatively, but I think the music is kind of beyond politics, really. It's on a higher level, so I like to stick with that.
And whenever we do these interviews, you get to play the last song. So I'd like you to pick a song that will play out. It could be anything you want. It could be one of yours. It could be a new song, an old song, someone by somebody else. Just a final song.
Well, I really would like to introduce one new song from my album.
Which one?
It's called One More.
Why that one?
Because this song kind of represents what this album is all about. This song is called One More. I say, I have one more song to sing. I have one more story to tell. I have one more arrow in my bow. I have one more shot at the prize. So, you know, it's kind of where I am at this point in time in my career.
Well, I hope you have many more songs in you, sir.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you very much indeed.
One. Six Music.
Is BBC Radio
Six Music.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.